Critias by Plato, written 360 BCE. Plato's dialogue, Critias, is the second in what had been planned as a trilogy of discourses. In Critias, which follows along closely after the action of Timaeus, Socrates continues to discuss the story of the war between Athens and Atlantis. The description of Atlantis from this dialogue follows. Critias is speaking.
And next, I have not forgotten what I heard when I was a child. I will impart to you the character and origin of the Athenians' adversaries. For friends should not keep their stories to themselves, but have them in common. Yet before proceeding further in the narrative, I ought to warn you that you must not be surprised if you should perhaps hear Hellenic names given to foreigners. I will tell you the reason of this. Solon, who was intending to use the tale for his poem, inquired into the meaning of the names, and found that the early Egyptians, in writing them down, had translated them into their own language. And he recovered the meaning of the several names, and when copying them out again, translated them into our language. My great-grandfather, Dropides, had the original writing, which is still in my possession, and was carefully studied by me when I was a child. Therefore, if you hear names such as are used in this country, you must not be surprised, for I have told you how they came to be introduced. The tale, which was of great length, began as follows. I have before me remarked in speaking of the allotments of the gods that they distributed the whole earth into portions differing in extent and made for themselves temples and instituted sacrifices. And Poseidon, receiving for his lot the island of Atlantis, begat children by a mortal woman and settled them in a part of the island which I will describe. Looking towards the sea, but in the center of the whole island, there was a plain which is said to have been the fairest of all plains and very fertile. Near the plain again, and also in the center of the island at a distance of about 50 stadia, there was a mountain not very high on any side. In this mountain there dwelt one of the earth-born primeval dwellers of that country, whose name was Evanor, and he had a wife named Leucippe, and they had an only daughter who was called Clito. The maiden had already reached womanhood when her father and mother died. Poseidon fell in love with her and had intercourse with her, and breaking the ground, enclosed the hill in which she dwelt all around, making alternate zones of sea and land larger and smaller, encircling one another. There were two of land and three of water, and he churned as with a lathe, each having its circumference equidistant, every way from the center, so that no living soul could get to the island, for ships and voyages were not as yet. He himself, being a god, found no difficulty in making special arrangements for the center island, bringing up two springs of water from beneath the earth, one of warm water and the other of cold, and making every variety of food to spring up abundantly from the soil. He also begat and brought up five pairs of male twin children, and dividing the island of Atlantis into 10 portions, he gave to the firstborn of the eldest pair his mother's dwelling and the surrounding allotment, which was the largest and best, and made him king over the rest. The others he made princes, and gave them rule over many men, and a large territory. And he named them all. The eldest, who was the first king, he named Atlas, and after him the whole island and the ocean were called Atlantis. To his twin brother, who was born after him, and obtained as his lot the extremity of the island towards the pillar of Heracles, facing the country which is now called the region of Gades in that part of the world, he gave the name which in the Hellenic language is Eumelus, in the language of the country which is named after him, Gadaris. Of the second pair of twins he called one Ampheres, and the other Evaimon. To the elder of the third pair of twins he gave the name Nicias, and Autochthon to the one who followed him. Of the fourth pair of twins he called the elder Elysippus, and the younger Mestor. And of the fifth pair he gave to the elder the name of Azias, and to the younger that of Diaprepes. All these and their descendants for many generations were the inhabitants and rulers of divers islands in the open sea. And also, has been already said, they held sway in our direction over the country within the pillars as far as Egypt and Tyrrhenia. Now Atlas had a numerous and honorable family, and they retained the kingdom, the elder son handing it on to his eldest for many generations. And they had such an amount of wealth as was never before possessed by kings and potentates, and is not likely ever to be again. And they were furnished with everything which they needed, both in the city and country. For because of the greatness of their empire, many things were brought to them from foreign countries, and the island itself provided most of what was required by them for the uses of life. In the first place, they dug out of the earth whatever was to be found there, solid as well as fusile, and that which is now only a name was then something more than a name, or a calcum, was dug out of the earth in many parts of the island, being more precious in those days than anything except gold. There was an abundance of wood for carpentry work, and sufficient maintenance for tame and wild animals. Moreover, there were a great number of elephants in the island, for as there was provision for all other sorts of animals, both for those which live in lakes and marshes and rivers, and also for those which live in mountains and on plains, so there was for the animal which is the largest and most voracious of all. Also, whatever fragrant things there now are in the earth, whether roots or herbage, or woods, or essences, which distill from fruit and flower, grew and thrived in that land. Also the fruit which admits of cultivation, both the dry sort, which is given us for nourishment, and any other which we use for food. We call them all by the common name pulse. And the fruits, having a hard rind, affording drinks and meats and ointments, and good store of chestnuts and the like, which furnish pleasure and amusement, and are fruits which spoil with keeping, and the pleasant kinds of dessert with which we console ourselves after dinner, when we are tired of eating, all these that sacred island which then beheld the light of the sun brought forth fair and wondrous and in infinite abundance. With such blessings the earth freely furnished them. Meanwhile they went on constructing their temples and palaces and harbors and docks. And they arranged the whole country in the following manner. First of all they bridged over the zones of sea which surrounded the ancient metropolis, making a road to and from the royal palace. And at the very beginning, they built the palace in the habitation of the god and of their ancestors, which they continued to ornament in successive generations, every sovereign surpassing the one who went before to the utmost of the regal power, until they made the building a marvel to behold for size and for beauty. Beginning from the sea, they bored a canal of 300 feet in width and 100 feet in depth, and 50 stadia in length, which they carried through to the outermost zone, making a passage from the sea up to this, which became a harbor, and leaving an opening sufficient to enable the largest vessels to find ingress. Moreover, they divided at the bridges the zones of land which parted the zones of sea, leaving room for a single trireme to pass out of one zone into another. And they covered over the channels so as to leave a way underneath for the ships, for the banks were grazed considerably above the water. Now the largest of the zones into which a passage was cut from the sea was 3 stadia in breadth, and the zone of land which came next of equal breadth. But the next 2 zones, the one of water, the other of land, were 2 stadia, and the one which surrounded the central island was 1 stadion only in width. The island in which the palace was situated had a diameter of 5 stadia. All this, including the zones and the bridge, which was the 1/6 part of 1 stadion in width, they surrounded by a stone wall on every side, placing towers and gates on the bridges where the sea passed in. The stone, which was used in the work, they quarried from underneath the center island, and from underneath the zones on the outer as well as the inner side. One kind was white, another black, and a third red. And as they quarried, they at the same time hollowed out double docks, having roofs formed out of the native rock. Some of their buildings were simple, but in others they put together different stones, varying the color to please the eye, and to be a natural source of delight. The entire circuit of the wall, which went round the outermost zone, they covered with a coating of brass, and the circuit of the next wall they coated with tin, and the third, which encompassed the citadel, flashed with the red light of orichalcum. The palaces in the interior of the citadel were constructed on this wise. In the center was a holy temple dedicated to Clito and Poseidon, which remained inaccessible and was surrounded by an enclosure of gold. This was a spot where the family of the 10 princes first saw the light, and thither the people annually brought the fruits of the earth in their season from all the 10 portions to be an offering to each of the 10. Here was Poseidon's own temple, which was 1 stadium in length, and 1/2 stadium in width, and of a proportionate height, having a strange barbaric appearance. All the outside of the temple, with the exception of the pinnacles, they covered with silver, and the pinnacles with gold. In the interior of the temple, the roof was of ivory, curiously wrought everywhere with gold and silver and orichalcum. And all the other parts, the walls and pillars and floor, they coated with orichalcum. In the temple they placed statues of gold. There the god himself standing in a chariot, the charioteer of 6 winged horses, and of such a size that he touched the roof of the building with his head. Around him were 100 Nereids, riding on dolphins, for such was thought to be the number of them by the human race of those days. There were also in the interior of the temple other images which had been dedicated by private persons. And around the temple on the outside were placed statues of gold of all the descendants of the 10 kings and of their wives. And there were many other great offerings of kings and of private persons coming both from the city itself and from the foreign cities over which they held sway. There was an altar, too, which in size and artistry corresponded to this magnificence. And the palaces in like manner answered to the greatness of the kingdom and the glory of the temple. In the next place they had fountains, one of cold and another of hot water, in gracious plenty flowing. And they were wonderfully adapted for use by reason of the pleasantness and excellence of their waters. They constructed buildings about them and planted suitable trees. Also they made cisterns, some open to the heavens, others roofed over, to be used in winter as warm baths. There were the royal baths and the baths of private persons, which were kept apart, and there were separate baths for women, and for horses and cattle, and to each of them they gave as much adornment as was suitable. Of the water which ran off, they carried some to the grove of Poseidon, where were growing all manner of trees of wonderful height and beauty, owing to the excellence of the soil, while the remainder was conveyed by aqueducts along the bridges to the outer circles. And there were many temples built and dedicated to many deities. Also gardens and places of exercise, some for people and others for horses, in both of the two islands formed by the zones. And in the center of the larger of the two, there was set apart a race course of a stadium in width, and in length allowed to extend all round the island for horses to race in. Also there were guard houses at intervals for the guards, the more trusted of whom were appointed to keep watch in the lesser zone, which was nearer the Acropolis, while the most trusted of all had houses given them within the citadel, near the royal persons. The docks were full of triremes and naval stores, and all things were quite ready for use. Enough of the plan of the royal palace. Leaving the palace and passing out across the three, you came to a wall which began at the sea and went all around. This was everywhere distant 50 stadia from the largest zone or harbor, and enclosed the whole, the ends meeting at the mouth of the channel which led to the sea. The entire area was densely crowded with habitations, and the canal and the largest of the harbors were full of vessels and merchants coming from all parts, who from their numbers kept up a multitudinous sound of human voices and din and clatter of all sorts night and day. I have described the city and the environs of the ancient palace nearly in the words of Solon. And now I must endeavor to represent the nature and arrangement of the rest of the land. The whole country was said by him to be very lofty and precipitous on the side of the sea, but the country immediately about and surrounding the city was a level plain, itself surrounded by mountains which descended towards the sea. It was smooth and even, and of an oblong shape, extending in one direction 3,000 stadia, but across the center inland, it was 2,000 stadia. This part of the island looked towards the south and was sheltered from the north. The surrounding mountains were celebrated for their number and size and beauty, far beyond any which still exist, having in form also many wealthy villages of country folk, and rivers, and lakes, and meadows supplying food enough for every animal, wild or tame, and much wood of various sorts, abundant for each and every kind of work. I will now describe the plain as it was fashioned by nature and by the labors of many generations of monarchs through long ages. It was for the most part rectangular and oblong, and where falling out of the straight line followed the circular ditch. The depth and width and length of this ditch were incredible, and gave the impression that a work of such extent, in addition to so many others, could never have been artificial. Nevertheless, I must say what I was told. It was excavated to the depth of 100 feet, and its breadth was a stadium everywhere. It was carried round the whole of the plain, and was 10,000 stadia in length. It received the streams which came down from the mountains, and winding round the plain and meeting at the city, was there let off into the sea. Further inland, likewise, straight canals of 100 feet in width were cut from it through the plain, and again let off into the ditch leading to the sea. These canals were at intervals of 100 stadia, and by them they brought down the wood from the mountains to the city, and conveyed the fruits of the earth in ships, cutting transverse passages from one canal into another, and to the city. Twice in the year they gathered the fruits of the earth in winter, having the benefit of the rains of heaven, and in summer the water which the land supplied by introducing streams from the canals. As to the population, each of the lots in the plain had to find a leader for the persons who were fit for military service, and the size of a lot was a square of 10 stadia each way, and the total number of all the lots was 60,000. And of the inhabitants of the mountains and of the rest of the country, there was also a vast multitude, which was distributed among the lots, and had leaders assigned to them according to their districts and villages. The leader was required to furnish for the war the sixth portion of a war chariot, so as to make up a total of 10,000 chariots, also 2 horses and riders for them, and a pair of chariot horses without a seat, accompanied by a rider who could also fight on foot, carrying a small shield, and having a charioteer who stood behind the warrior to guide the 2 horses. Also, he was bound to furnish 2 heavy armed soldiers, 2 slingers, 3 stone shooters, and 3 javelin throwers, who were light armed, and 4 sailors make up the complement of 1,200 ships. Such was the military order of the royal city. The order of the other 9 governments varied, and it would be wearisome to recount their several differences. As to offices and honors, the following was the arrangement from the first. Each of the 10 kings in his own division and in his own city had the absolute control of the citizens, and in the most cases of the laws punishing and slaying whomsoever the monarch chose. Now the order of the precedence among them and their mutual relations were regulated by the commands of Poseidon, which the law had handed down. These were inscribed by the first rulers on a pillar of orichalcum, which was situated in the middle of the island at the temple of Poseidon, whither the monarchs were gathered together every 5th and every 6th year alternately, thus giving equal honor to the odd and to the even number. When they were gathered together, they consulted about their common interests, and inquired if anyone had transgressed in anything and passed judgment. And before they passed judgment, they gave their pledges to one another on this wise. There were bulls who had the range of the temple of Poseidon. And the 10 kings, being left alone in the temple, after they had offered prayers to the god, that they might capture the victim which was acceptable to the god, hunted the bulls, without weapons, but with staves and nooses. And the bull which they caught, they led up to the pillar and cut its throat over the top of it, so that the blood fell upon the sacred inscription. Now on the pillar, besides the law, there was inscribed an oath invoking mighty curses on the disobedient. When, therefore, after slaying the bull in the accustomed manner, they had burnt its limbs, they filled a bowl of wine and cast in the clot of blood for each of them. The rest of the victim they put in the fire, after having purified the column all round. Then they drew from the bowl in golden cups, and pouring a libation on the fire, they swore that they would judge according to the laws on the pillar, and would punish anyone who in any point had already transgressed them, and that for the future they would not, if they could help, offend against the writing on the pillar, and would neither command others nor obey any ruler who commanded them to act otherwise than according to the laws of their father Poseidon. This was the prayer which they offered up for themselves and for their descendants, at the same time drinking and dedicating the cup out of which they drank in the temple of the gods. And after they had supped and satisfied their needs, when darkness came on, and the fire about the sacrifice was cool, all of them put on most beautiful azure robes, and sitting on the ground at night, over the embers of the sacrifices by which they had sworn, and extinguishing all the fire about the temple, they received and gave judgment, if any of them had an accusation to bring against any one. And when they had given judgment, at daybreak they wrote down their sentences on a golden tablet, and dedicated it together with their robes to be a memorial. There were many special laws affecting the several monarchs inscribed about the temples, but the most important was the following. They were not to take up arms against one another, and they were all to come to the rescue if anyone in any of their cities attempted to overthrow the royal house. Like their ancestors, they were to deliberate in common about war and other matters, giving supremacy to the descendants of Atlas. And the kings were not to have the power of life and death over any of their kin unless they had the assent of the majority of the 10. Such was the vast power which the god settled in the lost island of Atlantis. And this was afterwards directed against our land for the following reasons, as tradition tells. For many generations, as long as the divine nature lasted in them, they were obedient to the laws and well affectioned towards the deity, whose seed they were. For they possessed true and in every way great spirits, uniting gentleness with wisdom in the various chances of life and in their intercourse with one another. They despised everything but virtue, caring little for their present state of life, and thinking lightly of the possession of gold and other property, which seemed only a burden to them. Neither were they intoxicated by luxury, nor did wealth deprive them of their self-control. But they were sober and saw clearly that all these goods are increased by virtue and friendship with one another. Whereas by too great regard and respect for them, they are lost and friendship with them. By such reflections, and by the continuance in them of a divine nature, the qualities which we have described grew and increased among them. But when the divine portion began to fade away and became diluted too often and too much with the mortal admixture, and the human nature got the upper hand, They then, being unable to bear their fortune, behaved unseemly, and to anyone who had an eye to see grew visibly debased, for they were losing the fairest of their precious gifts. But to those who had no eye to see the true happiness, they appeared glorious and blessed at the very time when they were full of avarice and unrighteous power. Zeus, the god of gods, who rules according to law and is able to see into such things, perceiving that an honorable race was in a woeful plight and wanting to inflict punishment on them that they might be chastened and improved, collected all the gods into their most holy habitation, which, being placed in the center of the world, beholds all created things. And when he had called them together, he spoke as follows. The rest of the dialogue of Critias has been lost.